Kate to get us started. And so, Kate, whenever you're ready to begin, please do.
All right. Thank you, Jean. Before I turn it over to Jeff and Mike for their presentation, I wanted to give our attendees a brief overview of the EPA and Society of American Military Engineers, or SAMMEE, collaboration, which is referred to as Designing Construction Issues at Hazardous Waste Sites. EPA and SAMMEE have had this collaborative relationship since 2012, with the objectives listed here of facilitating open and frank information exchange among professionals to talk about, you know, the challenging design and construction issues we deal with specific to hazardous waste site remediation. Through our collaboration and a number of our training and symposium activities, we strive to provide a forum for presentations describing current practices and approaches, focusing on project management techniques and experiences to talk about these issues, enhance communications, and promote continued dialogue and discussion. In addition to the webinar series, of which this is one of the webinars, we have two in-person events that we do between EPA and SAMMEE. One of our events is the DCHWS East event, which is held in Philadelphia. We have our 13th annual delivery scheduled April 1st through 3rd of 2020 this year. The agenda is out and the registration is open. It's a large event, about 400 attendees that attend that. The main program is a day and a half, so if anyone is interested in looking into that, you can send me an email or Google it, and you can find registration and agenda information. In addition to that, we also have a sister symposium. It's a little bit smaller, about 250 folks, in the West in Denver. Our fifth delivery is scheduled for the last week of October 2020. I anticipate in the spring and summer that the registration, call for abstracts, and moderators will be sent out. In addition, there are some future DCHWS seminar series, including webinars and in-person training, which I'll talk about on the next slide. So we have 8 to 10 webinars planned for fiscal year 2020. I believe this is our fifth webinar. On the next slide, I'm going to provide an announcement for the next three upcoming webinars being held in March, April, and May. In addition to that, I just wanted to give folks a heads up. If you're a federal or private sector employee and you're interested in learning more about construction management, we do have an in-person construction management training that's scheduled for the first week in October of 2020 in Boston. More information will be shared on that as the agenda and the registration is open. So I encourage you to keep an eye out for that. Before I introduce our presenters, I just wanted to flash in front of you all that there are three upcoming webinars scheduled for March, April, and May, a variety of topics in the area of design and construction, cost risk management, heat-enhanced hydrologists for energetic compounds, and integration of resiliency and sustainability into remedy design and construction. So if any of those topics interest you or you think it would interest some of your colleagues, I encourage you to keep an eye on CLUIN and register when those events become available. Now, to get to today's presentation, I'd like to briefly introduce the presenters before I turn it over to them for the actual presentation. So we have two presenters from Jacobs. Our first presenter is Mike Perlmutter. He's a senior environmental engineer with Jacobs. He's been there since 2003. He's a licensed professional engineer in a number of states that you can see on the slide. He has 20 years of experience developing remediation strategies, evaluation of remedial alternatives, design, and supports construction and operation of remedy projects. He has a bachelor's in science and civil engineering from Georgia Institute of Technology, MS in civil engineering from the University of Texas at Austin. Joining Mike will be Jeff Minchak from Jacobs. He is a senior project manager with Jacobs since 2002. He has 29 years of experience planning, managing, and implementing site investigations and remedial actions on RCRA, CERCLA, and state lead projects. He is a senior technical resource for strategy, management, design, installation, operation, optimization related to vapor intrusion, and he has a Bachelor of Science in Earth Sciences from the Pennsylvania State University. So with that, Jeff and Mike, I'm going to turn it over to you to begin the technical content in your presentation.
Thanks, Kate. This is Mike Perlmutter. I'm going to kick things off, and Jeff and I are going to kind of tag team as we go through this presentation, depending on our areas of expertise. Ultimately, what we're going to be presenting today is nearly 15 plus years of work that we've done at a site out in New Mexico, where we've done everything from the investigation, design, construction, operation, and optimization of a large project where we implemented thermal treatment in Enhanced Bio. Our intention is really to kind of walk through the process, you know, spending a little bit of time on the front end circle stuff, but really focusing in on, you know, our design, our construction, and optimization, and really share that with you. Jeff and I will be doing the presentation, our roles in the project. I've been the lead engineer since 2006 on this project, and I've been also the subject matter expert for our bio component. Jeff has been the project manager at this project since 2002 and also wears a hat as the VI mitigation system subject matter expert. So between the two of us, we have a long history for the site and can speak about all these topics. Our agenda, as I mentioned before, is going to kind of cover the full spectrum of the project, give a little bit of site background just to get everybody up to speed on where this site is. Kind of briefly touch on our RI, FS, and record decision, and really the idea is to get to kind of show some of the unique elements of this project for those, because I know everybody's familiar with the CERCLA process. And then we'll get into the pre-design field investigation, which actually followed the record decision, and Jeff will talk a little bit more about that. And then get into the pilot studies and the design process. One of the interesting things about this particular project is we integrated a value engineering study during the design process that really helped to optimize the design and really led to the right remedy for the site right out of the gate. I'll get into the RA, remedial action implementation, and the optimization during construction. And we'll talk about the vapor intrusion mitigation systems, the thermal treatment systems, and the enhanced reduction dechlorination systems. At that point, I'll kind of stop and see if there's any questions. And then we'll move on to the long-term response action, which is essentially the operations of the remedy once we get to construction complete. I'll focus mostly on our optimization of the various components. And then the last piece of the puzzle here is that we're on the verge of transitioning this project from the EPA to state oversight. And Jeff will talk a little bit about what that's going to entail and how to promote a smooth transition. And then with that, I'll turn it over to Jeff to kind of walk through some of the site background.
All right, thank you. And thank you, everyone, for your interest in this project. And I'm going to open by talking a little bit about the site background. For starters, the site is located in Grants, New Mexico, which is a small town about 80 miles west of Albuquerque. It's along Interstate 40 and actually old Route 66. Goes right through the center part of town. This site is maybe about a quarter mile north of Route 66 as it goes through Grants. And it's adjacent to Interstate 40, modern day road. The elevation of the site is about 6,400 feet above sea level, so it's got some elevation to it out here near the Continental Divide in the U.S. The plume footprint here, which we show on the right, is about it's about a 20-acre area that you can see highlighted in green, and the plume is about 2,100 feet, so 2,100 feet long from the primary release area to its terminal point. And groundwater flow direction is from north-northwest to south-southeast. The figure on the right is oriented north. So the site history, the figure here shows the site with that northwest direction at the top of the page. The primary source area is in a commercial area, and the downgradient portions of the plume are largely in residential neighborhoods. If you look through the plume here, you can see that there's outlines of homes within that plume overlay. It was originally discovered during the investigation of a gasoline and diesel fuel releases from a nearby gas station. And, you know, when they were out sampling, they found chlorinated ethenes, largely PCE, in the groundwater. And the plume initially covered, as I mentioned, about 20 acres. And its maximum depth in the release area is about 100 feet below ground surface. Depth of water, very shallow here. A lot of people, including myself, when I first found out about the site, you're thinking, well, it's New Mexico. I wonder how deep groundwater is. It's only about 5 to 6 feet below ground surface, so very shallow water table. The site soils contain a significant amount of clay, which generally limited the vertical migration of the CVOCs, and we're going to take a look at that in a few more slides as we look at the site conceptual model. So most of the horizontal migration here is in two silty sand layers, and they're located no deeper than about 25 feet below ground surface. Again, the site was found to be associated with historical operations at a local business called the Holiday Dry Cleaners, the dry cleaning business, of course. EPA became involved in the site in the early 2000s, and the site was listed on the National Priorities List, the NPL, in July of 2004. And then as the project progressed, EPA committed to getting construction complete by the end of September of 2012. So here's a little chart that shows basically from 2001, beginning with the PASI, which is the Preliminary Assessment Site Inspection, which was performed by the state of New Mexico, the Environment Department. It only took about 11 years to get all the way through to construction complete by the end of federal FY12, so by the end of September 2012. And, you know, lots of very interesting things, lots of challenging things happened in between here. You know, following the CERCLA process, you know, the RI, the FS, the Record of Decision, and then, of course, all of the design and testing processes that we went through, activities that were completed, and then going, of course, into construction and then into the LTRA. So in that time, like I said, the entire CERCLA process was implemented. It also included the installation of over 700 permanent injection wells for the enhanced reductive dechlorination remedy. So we'll talk a lot more about that here in several slides. So let's take a brief look. Like Mike said, we do want to focus more on the actual technical side of it, but on the administrative side, let's take a look at the RIFS, the Remedial Investigation Feasibility Study, and then ultimately the decision document, the Record of Decision that was completed for the site. So again, the study of the PCE after discovery by the Petroleum Storage Tank Investigation transitioned to the New Mexico Environment Department, their Groundwater Quality Bureau, and they have a subsection called Superfund Oversight. So the Superfund Oversight took over, and they conducted the PASI at this point, you know, beginning to work with EPA. And then during 2001 and 2002, the site transitioned EPA. Region 6, the grants, New Mexico is located in Region 6, and it was considered, the site was considered for listing on the NPL, the National Priority List. In August 2002, EPA Region 6 issued a task order under CH2M Hill's Remedial Action Contract, and soil and groundwater sampling was performed using direct push technology methods, so geoprobe type approaches. And groundwater samples were collected from existing monitoring wells that had been installed as part of the underground storage tank investigation and then during the subsequent PASI. It's worth noting, and we'll get into details about the complexities of it, but no monitoring wells were actually installed during the RI. Sounds kind of strange, but it actually worked out well in the end. Also, on behalf of the EPA, the USGS, the Geological Survey, did perform additional sampling of groundwater using additional DPT sampling. They also sampled the existing monitoring wells, and they performed some aquifer testing. And then CH2M Hill performed vapor intrusion-related sampling of basement air, crawl space air, indoor air, and outdoor air to evaluate the VI pathway at the site. And then EPA elected to abbreviate the RI and push detailed data collection to the RD process. At the end of the abbreviated RI, there was enough data available to understand the site conditions and to identify the appropriate remedial alternatives. And again, EPA also conducted a baseline human health risk assessment, and due to the site location and features, an ecological risk assessment was not required. So the feasibility study completed in January of 2006, and then the ROD completed only 6 months later. So we were able to use the data from the abbreviated RI and complete the FS. A cafeteria style or a menu style feasibility study and subsequently the Record of Decision were completed. This was done to allow flexibility during the RD. What this really means in practice is that multiple viable technologies were identified as remedial alternatives. You know, there's a certain key subset of technologies that will work given the site conditions, but that those technologies could be implemented as needed within the limits of the plume once the detailed information was available. So basically you had this list of things that were available like on a menu, and you could pick from them depending on where you are within the plume. So again, in only 6 months, it went from completed FS to assigned ROD. EPA was able to fast track it in their internal processes, and it worked. So the site was placed under one operable unit, but the design and installation of the vapor intrusion mitigation systems, that was implemented sooner as a separate activity so that the completed pathway could be addressed, you know, whilst other activities were going on to address source materials and the rest of the downgradient plume. So in the FS, the site was broken into five remedial action components, including indoor air, source area treatment, this is in the groundwater then, source area treatment, shallow plume core and hotspot, shallow plume periphery, and deeper groundwater. And remedial alternatives and estimated costs were then identified for each. So then, of course, in the ROD selects, you know, the technologies that are the remedial alternatives from the FS. And the red circles show the remedial alternatives selected for each component in the ROD and the associated baseline estimated cost for each. And you can see that the initial findings from the FS and then the ROD supported costs of about $29.2 million. And you can see that, you know, that for indoor air, of course, the vapor intrusion mitigation systems were selected. Source air treatment did select in situ thermal treatment, so ISTT, and then ISCO with follow-on ERD for the shallow plume core hotspot, which also had significant concentrations of PCE and other ethenes. And then the ERD for as biobarrier transects for shallow plume periphery in the deeper groundwater. So as defined in the ROD, this is what it looks like broken down by remedial alternative within the plume. More aggressive technologies such as thermal treatment and in situ chemical oxidation were selected, where the PCE concentrations were the highest, and of course the vapor intrusion mitigation systems were selected to disconnect the vapor intrusion pathway throughout the plume. So it's interesting to look at this. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but you know, the thermal treatment was focused up in the hotspot area, the highest concentration hotspot areas, and where the chlorinated PCE went deeper. And again, these are the initial findings coming out of the record of decision. So now after the ROD was signed, the site moved into the RD phase, including collecting the detailed site characterization data that had not been collected during the RI, and it included performing pilot studies for both ISCO and the ERD using the vegetable oil, and also then, of course, completing the RD. So let's look at the key objectives here for the PDFI, the pre-design field investigation. So to address the uncertainty and collect the necessary detailed data to support the RD, the pre-design field investigation was undertaken. And again, it was to verify and revise the approaches that had been selected in the ROD, fine-tune where needed. Again, we had the opportunity to do that because of the way the ROD was written with flexibility. And so from May of 2007 through roughly January 2009, additional groundwater monitoring, soil sampling, and detailed investigation at two identified source areas. So there was both the active dry cleaners, and then there was another old dry cleaning business that had only been in operation for a little while and was a much less significant source. So we did more sampling and testing, which I'm going to cover in the next page. And then, of course, we did the treatability study for both ISCO and ERD at two locations within the shallow plume core. Excuse me. So one of the tools that we used was a membrane interface tool, so membrane interface probe, so it's the MIP tool, was used in the primary source area at the Holiday Cleaners, and that was used to significantly refine the CSM. You know, when you're considering using thermal treatment, it's quite the expensive technology, but it can, you know, really go in and knock down you know, your very hot spots, which we used it for at this site, but we needed to really understand what that footprint looked like. So the four figures on the left show increasing levels of ECD, the electron capture device response, indicating increasing PCE concentrations from mostly dissolved phase in the bright green color in the upper left to potential DNAPL in the dark red color in the bottom right. So in the center, in the graphic shown in the center, you can see these areas of PCE plotted in the subsurface with that largely that red blob translating to the red blob from the MIP data into the CSM central figure. And then moving on to the right, it shows the two shallow transmissive units of silty sand that allow for the greatest horizontal migration of the PCE. And that's how this plume really got its 2,100-foot length in the long direction, but then only about 100-foot vertical because there's these large clay layers up at the surface and then these higher K zones where the transmission of the PCE was allowed to happen and sort of whisk it away before it could go too deep. Okay, Mike, back to you.
Thanks, Jeff. So moving away from the source area, now that we had that delineated, you know, the next piece of the puzzle for the design process was really trying to understand the geochemistry and the hydrogeology of the site so we could design the remainder of our groundwater remedies. And just some of the key features that we learned as part of the PDFI included the fact, again, is that the groundwater is very shallow. We certainly, you know, influenced our ability to perhaps inject and certainly was a factor in the vapor intrusion issue as well. There was a downward vertical gradient. The groundwater velocity wasn't consistent across, you know, vertically across the site, so we had to plan for that as well. We already had mildly anaerobic geochemical conditions, and then coupled with that, you know, where we had commingling of the petroleum plume and the chlorinated solvent plume, we already saw evidence of reductive chlorination going on. So that was certainly a clue to us that, you know, ERD was certainly a possibility at this site. So that was sort of fortuitous in that respect. What was interesting about this site, though, is that you got sulfate concentrations well over 1,000 parts per million, in some cases over 5,000 parts per million. And I know that in some cases with ERD designs, that's a bit of a red flag. So that's something that we certainly kept in mind as we were moving forward and certainly consider that there may be an abiotic component to the degradation process. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. And then you had water that had fairly elevated dissolved solids as well. So that was a factor as well as in our design. So with that background in mind, we started on two different treatability studies, both in the plume core, to more refine our ISCO and our ERD remedies. Both were fairly similar. They were on small scale where we had anywhere from one to three injection points. We started with ISCO. Again, the idea was essentially to assess, you know, oxygen demand, oxygen effectiveness, you know, groundwater injection rates, those kinds of things so we could plan the full-scale design. We started with a potassium permanganate solution injected in this area. We generally focused our attention on those upper two permeable zones, as Jeff had talked about, and we had a series of monitoring wells clustered around them to assess rates of influence and impacts over time. Ultimately, we were very happy with the injection flow rates, up to 12 gallons per minute, which certainly helps our costs if we're able to inject a substantial amount of liquid over time. We saw ROI of 12 feet. The persistence was not what we were looking for. It was only about 3 to 6 months. And we didn't see the order of magnitude VOC reduction that we were expecting from the ISCO. And the ORP did not respond as well. So ISCO did remain a technology in our arsenal, but we realized that during the design process we did need to adjust it, perhaps consider some other oxidants like persulfate, adjust our concentrations of our dose and our injection frequency. And we also started realizing that we needed to split up our injection well screens to really focus in on the intervals that Jeff had mentioned before. Concurrent with our ISCO test and a little bit further down gradient, we started looking at ERD. In this particular case, we did a transect of three injection wells, and we looked at a EVO, or emulsified vegetable oil solution, in those intervals. In this case, rather than just focusing on the shallow intervals, we actually looked at going from 10 to 60 feet below ground surface. So we were hitting not only those shallow intervals, but also some of those intermediate intervals as well, and really get a handle on the hydraulic properties as well. We installed a number of monitoring wells to assess effectiveness and ROI, and the VOC concentration changes over time. Ultimately, we wanted to get first order decay rates, so again, we could plan our remedy accordingly. In this particular case, we saw injection flow rates up to 15 GPM with an average of 10. The ROI was 12 feet. And unlike the ISCO, we did see some longer-term persistence of our substrate. So upwards of 24 months post-injection, we were seeing the conditions we needed to see for ERD to happen. We saw nearly 100% PCE degradation, which was our primary constituent, and we saw cis and vinyl chloride show up. Now, at the time, we were very excited to see those things come up, but certainly today, we were a lot more sensitive about daughter products. But I think the fact that we saw the haplocoides concentrations bloom as part of this effort, I think our projection was that we would make this work. So ERD remained part of this remedy, and we also, again, realized that multiple injection wells were required for this to be implemented. So coming out of the PDFI and the pilot studies, we sort of reset our remedies for the site. For the abandoned cleaners, which originally was a thermal treatment system along with the holiday cleaners, we actually pulled back a little bit. The concentrations were a lot lower than we thought, and we shifted over to an SVE system. So essentially almost an unthermally enhanced SVE in a sense. We retained ISCO for the shallow plume core, and then ERD was for the remainder of the plume. So in some respects, it stayed the simmer, but it was a bit refined. And then you can see the component that was the monitoring and injection well installation. So with a remedy over $30 million, at that point in time, our EPA project manager just elected to implement a value engineering study to optimize the remedy for completing the RD process. So this is sort of another optimization tool that we used during the RD process to really fine-tune the remedy, perhaps control costs, but certainly improve its functionality. So we embarked on a value engineering study. I think it was around 2009-2010 timeframe. And the way that we looked at it was that it was essentially a second feasibility study. We had all this information that we gathered during the PDFI, and now we were able to use it to do a much more comprehensive assessment of the remedies for the site. For those of you that aren't aware, value engineering was developed by GE during World War II. It's oftentimes used for defense, transportation, construction, and healthcare, but sometimes in environmental remediation projects, really to either improve functionality of a remedy or to reduce costs. So it really boils down to a fairly simple equation for a value engineering study, and it's basically value equals function over cost. And ultimately, if we're able to go through this value engineering study and improve the function of our remedies and keep costs constant, we get much more value from our remedy. And then likewise, if we're able to at least meet the function of the remedy and fine-tune the design so the costs go down, we see a growth in value also. So that was really the focus of this value engineering study. We looked at all the parts of the remedy, all the media, all the various components from the source area down to the distal plume, and really just wanted to enhance the remedy and ultimately maybe perhaps try to reduce the cost down from $30 million. This was a fairly comprehensive event. Starting with some background information, this was really confined to about a week. We brought in a number of key participants to the process, including a VE specialist, experts in hydrogeology, ISCO, thermal, ERD, and the independent design review from another contractor. EPA and New Mexico were heavily involved, and then the project team. So we all got together and really just sort of opened the doors to trying to find the right solution for this site. So the way that this unfolded is that there's actually five phases to the VE study, starting with the information phase. The information phase is really to educate all the participants in the site background, provide all the data that we've collected to this point, and really get them set for this process. But it's also to answer five basic questions. What is the problem we're about to discuss? Why do we consider this a problem? Why do we believe a solution is necessary? What are the top cost drivers on this project? What are the top risk areas in the project? And really sets the tone for how to build, sort of new remedies for the site within the confines of the ROD, of course. So the next phase is the creative phase, and this is where we sort of define the functions of the project. And this starts with the highest order, which basically includes describing the overall purpose of the project, which really is protect health, restore resources, and protect resources. really the fundamentals to any kind of remediation project at the site. And then we get into sort of basic functions, reducing chlorinated solvent mass, minimizing vapor intrusion, eliminate contamination source to groundwater, achieve MCLs, essentially the REOs for the project, the remedial action objectives. And then moving down the function ladder, we get to secondary functions. Now, these are meaningful yet secondary elements of the project that need to be accommodated to deliver the project. And this includes, perhaps shortening the duration of the RA, reducing remediation timeframes, making sure we're not disrupting the community or businesses, and really sort of being mindful of that aspect. And then the last function is sort of things that we need to meet all the time, being mindful of costs, protecting workers, minimizing inconvenience, and then using sustainable practices and solutions. So the job of the VE team was to brainstorm alternatives, develop as many ideas as possible that could meet the functions that I just said. There was no judging. It was a complete brainstorming operation at a particular time. So ultimately, what we ended up doing is developing 31 ideas for improving the remedy at the site, and 20 of them passed. We talked about advantages and disadvantages for them. We looked at various cost savings or not cost savings. In some cases, we had a cost increase, but the function of the remedy increased, and all of those were kept in place. So you can see on the screen here, just the range of ideas that we came up with that were passed as part of the creative phase. Looking at different carbon substrates, looking at soil excavation. We looked at even moving the holiday cleaners and allowing us to get in there and perhaps ease the remedy in the source area, changing the dimensions of our remedies, those kinds of things as well. Some more passing ideas. We looked at, using DPT delivery instead of permanent injection wells in the streets. We looked at horizontal wells versus vertical wells. One-pass trenches instead of vertical injection wells, perhaps to set up PRBs, kind of to cut up the plume. We even looked at switching remedies to, does air sparging make sense of ERD? And then also looked at M&A. Was M&A a viable component rather than doing ERD through this fairly large plume? Did it make sense to perhaps do an M&A / long-term monitoring program at the site? And we looked at all those as well. We also had a number of failing ideas, just to let you guys know that we did sort of reject some of the things that we came up with. We looked at soil mixing in the source areas. A range of various alternatives, including, use of zero valent iron injections at the time, surfactant flushing, expanding the IC system, looking at solar power bioreactors, going so far as to look at fiber remediation in particular cases as well. So you can see that we really ran the gamut of particular ideas for this site. So once we had our 20 passing ideas, we then began the ranking process. We looked at, community scores, cost, implementability, safety, treatment effectiveness, sustainability, utilities. And then we provided a weighting factor, because some of these things are obviously more important than others. The EPA New Mexico weighed in, and then the technical team went ahead and scored all the ideas based on, these weighting factors and ultimately whether they met the function or not. Also part of this process was to develop some cost estimates for every single one of these alternatives. So we prepared 20 cost estimates during the week that we were together, and we were able to pull numbers from our feasibility study, previous experience. It was really just kind of getting together and really getting an idea about, what was the order of magnitude of these ideas and what could they do for us. So ultimately, we took these 20 passing ideas and developed proposals for them. And at the end of the day, we ended up with 7 proposals pulled together, and the 7 proposals covered the entire extent of the site. And we actually were able to determine that we could have a maximum potential life cycle cost savings of nearly $20 million, so almost 60% of the total life cycle cost of the RD. Now, I think some of the choices that we made for that were perhaps beyond what the EPA was interested in, and we ended up settling on a recommended remedy that shaved $8 to $12 million off the life cycle cost. So pretty significant. So at the end of the day, the EPA endorsed a revision to the remedy. This essentially became what came out of the preliminary design and what moved into the intermediate and final design process. We opted to look at alternative carbon substrates rather than specifying a particular one. We looked at soil excavation off-site disposal instead of soil vapor extraction for the abandoned cleaners. We looked at kind of removing the sewer lateral, which was really a major component in how the plume moved away from the cleaners. Relocating and demolishing the building became a choice to really improve the efficacy and ease of installation of the thermal treatment system. And then we talked about basically shifting the ERD system and ultimately eliminating ISCO. So ISCO was eliminated at this point because it just didn't make sense for this particular site. And then perhaps most importantly, the EPA, New Mexico, and the team decided that we would be able to use M&A long-term monitoring in the deep portion of plume where concentrations were lower. And that was 60 to 70% of the cost savings. But having everybody together in the room to make these decisions made the process a lot easier. The VE investment, to get everybody together and do this work and write the report was about $100,000. But in order to save, $10 million of lifecycle cost, ended up being 100-to-1 return on investment. So apparent, seemingly well worth the investment. One more stage to the process. So we came out of the VE study with a revised remedy. And then as we worked through the remainder of the design process, we did make some additional tweaks to the remedy. We elected to, for example, not relocate the dry cleaners and demolish the existing structure. I think there was some precedent setting that the EPA did not want to get into, and certainly understandable. So we had to work with that as far as the ISTT. We shifted the abandoned cleaners remedy once again. I think this is the third or fourth shift during this process. Again, sort of in the spirit of optimization. Because the concentrations were declining, we shifted over to an LPM process rather than doing anything active. And then while we left the VE study considering horizontal wells for the delivery of substrates, as we moved through the design process, we decided to continue with a vertical well strategy and rather than getting into the horizontal wells. I think one of the reasons why we did not go with horizontal wells, and the idea was to perhaps install them underneath infrastructure within the city of Grant. I think there was a concern about putting carbon substrate directly under houses, and being concerned basically of daylighting, and also sort of exacerbating a kind of a methane generation intrusion process, which we'll get into a little bit later. Otherwise, with some of the other remedies, we kept and moved forward from there. Sorry, Jeff. I was going to introduce you. So we're going to get in the RA process implementation. And the first thing that we did here is install the VIMS, as Jeff had alluded to before, and I'll let him kind of walk through that. So thanks, Jeff.
All right. So as we had talked about, the first thing we did was, sort of foreshorten some of the process here to get through the into the remedial action and get the vapor intrusion mitigation systems into the ground. And we wanted to do that for obvious reasons. It's a completed pathway, and it ideally is addressed as soon as possible. So residential VIMS were designed and installed from 2007 to 2010 to address the completed pathway. It was done in sort of a first phase, and there had been some people that didn't want to participate. Then once they saw us installing them, they then elected to participate in the process. So frankly, we were happy to have them in and go in and get that structure mitigated. So again, it was completed separately and ahead of the rest of the RD process, so we could address the pathway. And a cool thing about the grants project now, this far into it, including in the treatment, is that as the treatment of the groundwater has progressed, we're going to collect some data here this year to evaluate whether some of the VIMS can be removed from service, because looking at the progress that we're going to talk about with the groundwater system, there may be an opportunity here that some of these VIMS might not be needed anymore, and that'd be a really good thing. But first, let's talk about the VIMS themselves. First, here are some of the structure-specific items that we evaluate when we go out and we look to put in a mitigation system into a structure. It has to try and fit as holistically as possible in with the structure. So we look at foundation types, the overall layout of the structure. In this case, they were residential homes or apartments. You look at the construction and the roof type, interior and exterior finishes, things you might be disturbing and have to put back or match for color finishes. Also looking at home heating and cooling systems, look at the HVAC systems associated with the homes, where they are, what they are, how they act and operate. Electrical wiring type and location of the panel box. I will say here a lot of our challenges were around substandard electrical systems when we got into a house. Also, look at the options for placement of ventilation piping and homeowner preferences. You know, you can see in the upper right here that photo, there's certainly, you know, something. There's a physical thing, a radon-type mitigation fan and PVC pipe that are going to be outside of the structure that they're going to have to see. So it's nice to put it, if at all possible, in a spot that's amenable to the homeowner and, you know, ideally painted to match so that it sort of blends in as best it can. Also, you have to look at constructability issues, things such as soil type, ground surface conditions. When you're putting barriers down in a crawl space, is there problems with surface water run-on during rainstorms and snow melt and things like that? And also the potential presence of lead-based paint and asbestos-containing materials. A lot of that gets addressed during investigation sometimes where, you know, you're wondering if there's floor tiles in the way that might have asbestos in them, but it certainly becomes compounded more if you're actually going out and coring holes and interacting with the physical properties of the building that might have lead paint or asbestos on them. And then post-installation, you know, first of all, the VIMS doesn't treat indoor air. It just mitigates the VI preferential flow pathway to indoor air. So again, these don't treat. They just interrupt the pathway and allow that air to short circuit to the atmosphere and not be allowed to build up inside a house. So to demonstrate the efficacy of the systems, the design specified a minimum pressure differential across the foundation slabs, or an installed membrane, or between the crawl space and indoor air, depending on what two set bases you are trying to separate from based on the way the building is constructed. In this case, though, the systems are from back in 2007 design. The pressure differential goal was based more around a radon pressure differential of 1 Pascal, 0.04 inches of water column. I would say that today they would be designed probably to a higher number, higher differential pressure. But again, the goal is to demonstrate that this negative pressure is being maintained by the VIMS across the barrier at a given structure, and they do that successfully. And generally speaking, they're larger vacuum differentials than just 1 Pascal. So after the systems were installed, we do go out and do air sampling. Indoor air sampling was performed, and then we use the applied vacuum and pressure field extension, the differential pressure, to demonstrate that the pathway continues to be disconnected. So some of the challenges with VIMS, for those of you that do vapor intrusion work, you're probably familiar with these. Owners and occupants change, and they may or may not elect to keep a mitigation system operating. We have to address this continually through communications with owners and occupants. A lot of times there's tenants. Sometimes they are on – the systems were paid for by the EPA, and they were installed, and physical upkeep, the O&M, is paid for by EPA at this point, but the owner pays for electricity. Some owners just turn them off or feel that they're not important enough to keep running. So, again, the maintenance of the systems is addressed by EPA, but the operation itself is largely up to the owners and the occupants, and we do have an ongoing communications program to remind them of the importance of that. Ambient air quality was initially a concern due to fugitive emissions from the dry cleaning operation. However, the dry cleaner no longer uses PCE, so we're not worried about re-entrainment of, you know, with structures that are downwind of the dry cleaners during dry cleaning operations. For the installation, we ended up using a Central New Mexico-based radon installation contractor, who, frankly, we had to help them implement a strong safety program and also understand the nature of the VOCs as compared to a radon, and it was successful. This person was willing to work with us, and we had a good outing. Another thing, right now we're talking about, as the remedy progresses, when can these VIMS be removed from service? But one thing we're being cognizant of is the fact that daughter products now exist, mostly vinyl chloride, that were not initially present. So although the dechlorination process is complete, you know, the daughter products are still present for some time in the subsurface. So that is something we're addressing, and we'll have more on that in a few slides, or more slides in a little bit. Mike?
Thanks, Jeff. So with the VIMS systems in place, we moved on to putting in the remainder of the remedy for the site. The first thing that went in the ground basically is our thermal treatment system. And at the end of the day, we treated about 3/4 of an acre to depths of about 25 to 40 feet below our ground surface. And if you recall from that MIP visual that we had before, we were able to kind of adjust the depth of the bottoms of the thermal system based on what we have found in terms of where there might be some dean apple. So if you look closely at the figure on the left side of the graphic, I don't know, Gene, if we can get the arrow to come for me. Thank you. So if you can look carefully here, and this was also on our original figure, we have these green and red shapes, and they basically designate the depth of the treatment. So right underneath the holiday cleaners, we were down to 40 feet. We did 25 feet, 40 feet, and then 25 feet as we moved across. Ultimately, we treated about 33,000 cubic yards of soil and about 2 million gallons of groundwater as we were circulating through the system in about 9 months. One of the challenges we faced as part of this was maintaining an active dry cleaners during the entire process, and then also keeping the state roadway open during construction. You can see here, this is the first street that basically split the site. This was pre-drone era, so we had the benefit of Google Earth stopping by twice during our remedy and taking a picture of our remedy during construction. You can see the vapor cap here and all the conveyance piping connected to our thermal system, the compound here located off to the side. And then this shows us the site after they finished, kind of leaving this main fence in place. The property owners actually kind of like that. But ultimately, as I'll talk about before, working around the holiday cleaners and the roadway was an interesting challenge for this particular site. So to address the active dry cleaners, A number of our infrastructure had to be installed from the outside. So we used a combination of hollow stem auger and mini-sonic to install a number of angled borings to install our heater borings. We used electrical resistance heating. So we installed our electrodes and our extraction wells all at angles under the building. We also were able to get into the dry cleaners after hours and install some fairly shallow electrodes and vapor recovery wells through the floor of the dry cleaners, all installed by hand. So we had to do that as well after hours. And then the next thing that we did as part of protecting the dry cleaners during operation is we installed a false floor throughout the entire building. And this allowed us to mitigate some of the temperature from below. It's already hot enough as it is in a dry cleaners, as many of you are aware. But it also gave us a plenum to extract vapors. So we had basically two plywood separated with insulation and an air gap to allow us to do extraction. And we even went so far as to extend their pedals on some of their equipment so they could continue to operate during the process. Again, this is just another visual of the treatment system you saw on the front cover, just showing sort of the extensiveness of the system. The other main challenge that we had at the site was crossing the road, but also heating underneath it. So you can see that there's a number of, we had to basically close down two lanes of the three-lane road at all times and install the infrastructure in trenches, mostly conveyance lines. We actually installed two separate electrical systems, so not to cross the road with a fairly substantial power source. We had to build that into our system as well. So this is mostly just vapor system going across. And then we installed all the infrastructure in vaults within the right-of-way of the street. So I think we ended up with about 30 or 40 vaults of all the system in place, and then we repaved the entire area. The other interesting thing that we had to deal with at the site also is there's a 6-inch diameter natural gas line that's running down the first street as well, and the natural gas company was obviously very protective of their natural gas line. So we had to build a system in place to run a thermocouple alongside of the gas line to measure the temperature, and then we installed a quench line that was triggered if we basically exceeded about 40 degrees Celsius. So we were sort of fighting ourselves in a sense because we wanted to raise the temperature at the site to nearly 100 degrees Celsius, and we had this one zone where we had to kind of fight ourselves. So as you can see in some of these thermal images, you can see where the road and the gas line is located because you have this gap in the heating. But as you get below it, you can see where we've met our temperature goal. So another interesting challenge was part of the site that we had to deal with. And because we had a sequential or a combined remedy, some of the challenges that we faced with the thermal tribute system, we were able to kind of catch with the implementation of the biosystem. One of the interesting things about thermal tribute systems, and I guess it's not interesting, is that they're relatively expensive. And the key is knowing when to turn it off. It's not necessarily practical to treat a site all the way down to RGs, particularly since you're using a tremendous amount of electricity to maintain the heat. So as part of our remedies, we developed two essentially performance goals to develop. Ultimately, a numerical standard was our goal. If we happen to achieve that, that would certainly cause us to stop operation and decommission the system. We also built into the shutdown sequence a diminishing returns performance goal also. So we would constantly look at the cumulative energy balance, subsurface temperature, how much mass are we pulling out of the ground, and just the overall performance. And collectively with all the stakeholders, including EPA, make a decision about whether to terminate the system or not. Again, recognizing that we had a bioremediation system in order to kind of follow up behind us. Part of making the decision was once we achieved that step, we would go out there and collect some confirmation soil samples and then make some decisions about whether to proceed. That diminishing returns process allowed us to stay on schedule meet our construction completion milestone. So we're now in the 2012 timeframe in terms of our remedy deployment. So at the same time as our thermal treatment system, we started implementing our ERD remedy down gradient. We also had to do some more of the ERD remedy around our source area as a polishing step for our thermal, but that had to happen after our thermal treatment system finished, of course, because it's difficult to install wells when you've got 100 degrees Celsius underground. Ultimately, our remedy included EVO injected into over 700 injection wells, as Jeff had mentioned earlier. We elected to choose a transect approach, mostly working with the city right-of-ways, and the idea, again, was to kind of break apart this plume as best as possible. Some of the design details, we injected about 150 gallons of a 3 to 5% EVO solution per foot of well screen. That was essentially our beginning design. Our early injection events took 2 to 3 months. And another unique feature, maybe not unique, but interesting feature of this is because we're working essentially in a neighborhood, it was very difficult for us to install any kind of permanent injection infrastructure. So our entire injection operation was mobile. We installed all of our infrastructure and trailers, pulled behind trucks, and then basically set up and broke down every day. One of the benefits that we had is a drilling company that installed all the injection wells was located 4 miles from the site, so we're able to use their yard to store all of our equipment and our substrate as well. So that was a fairly optimal situation for us. The design included about 18 months of reinjection frequency, and ultimately our projection was that it was going to take upwards of 20 years of treatment to meet our goals. Some of the optimization that we built into actually the construction of the remedy, when we installed some of our early injection wells, and if you remember, we decided to do multiple injection well screens to address the entire almost 100-foot interval. So in some cases, we've had 6 injection well screens at one single injection location. That's how we ended up with 700 wells. So when we first started installing our wells, once we got in a couple of different designs, we did some injection tests and to check sort of radius of influence and injection flow rates and made an adjustment to the rest of the injection wells to make sure that they were installed and operating as efficiently as possible. That was sort of our first optimization step. We also just elected to sample some of the injection wells after we installed them. So we sort of selectively installed some of the injection wells, not necessarily in a row along the transect, but allowed us to get some more information about the size of the plume and either expand or contract our injection well array. Again, to spend sort of an optimal amount of money in order to deliver the remedy. We did some tracer testing during the full-scale injection. And another thing that we did, in the spirit of optimization, is that we divided the injection field into 3 areas and injected 3 different commercial substrates at the time, rather than just focusing on one. And the idea was essentially to have a competition among the substrates to see which one performed the best. And depending on a number of metrics, then use that substrate for the subsequent events. And then we gradually implement a bioaugmentation as well. You know, going out there and doing an injection event of 700 wells of bioaugmentation didn't seem particularly cost effective. So we sort of gradually did it in order to make sure that it made sense for a particular area before we expanded to the whole site. Some of the challenges we faced, and some of them I've already touched upon, dealing with, a 20-acre plume in an active urban area, we had to work around, that we were working in city streets and around people's houses. We had to use the mobile injection units. Implementing a comprehensive traffic management plan during every time we go out there and sample an injection and do an injection was critical to the success of the remedy. And, of course, managing inquisitive residents also is a factor as well. I mentioned the fact that we've got a fairly stratified lithology and having to do multiple nested monitoring well, injection wells and monitoring wells in order to implement the remedy. As Jeff alluded to at the beginning, we had a fairly compressed schedule to get from design through construction complete. We actually ended up doing four separate mobilizations to implement the ERD, working around the ISTT, and funding restrictions. So we had to be nimble in that respect. We had incremental funding at the time of the remedy implementation. That's when we had the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funding. And because we were good to go and had shovels ready, we were able to integrate that into the remedy, and a lot of the injection wells at the site were built using that money. And it was also an asset to the local driller who at the time was affected by the downturn in the economy. Again, I mentioned the fact that we had to do angled borings. So not only did we do angled borings for the thermal treatment system, but we had to do angled borings underneath the Holloway cleaners in order to apply amendment to the deeper zones that we elected to do bio instead of thermal. The high desert setting was a challenge, something that I wasn't used to sitting here in Atlanta, seeing 40, 50, 60 degree temperature swings over the course of the day was sort of unique to me. And we had to manage our substrate handling around the freezing temperatures in the morning and 60 degree temperatures in the afternoon. So that certainly had to be a factor in how we delivered the substrate as well. Early on in the process, we also spent a lot of time trying to study and understand biogas generation, accumulation, and migration. So in addition to the VOC vapor intrusion, we also looked very closely at methane generation and hydrogen sulfide generation. As you recall, we had a substantial amount of sulfate at the site, so hydrogen sulfide generation was a risk. We ended up installing upwards of 50 shallow vapor monitoring points and developed a risk management plan to address potential methane and hydrogen sulfide generation. Over time, we learned that the attenuation of methane, even in the 5-foot zone above the groundwater table, was enough to protect the residents. So we were able to kind of ease back on our vapor monitoring, but it was something that we really focused our attention on early in the process. And again, the sulfate concentrations was a unique situation at the time, and I think this is the beginning of our community's understanding of how abiotic transformation could be a powerful addition. So we started looking at whether the formation of iron sulfides could actually help us in time rather than be a detriment to the remedy. So after the implementation and the early optimization, this is about 3 or 4 years into our remedy, we immediately reduced our CVOC mass by more than 90%. A bulk of that was certainly the influence of the ISTT, 80% of the decrease because, we basically knocked out the source area. But the ERD was progressing very nicely within those first 5 years. The mass within just the dissolved areas where we're treating ERD had decreased by 60%, and we had shifted everything more towards cis and vinyl chloride, sort of working down the classic dechlorination pathway. We also saw a shift of the plume, the center of mass, but ultimately we're sort of dealing with the same footprint at this particular time. So with that, before I get into the optimization we did during operations, I will be happy to, Jeff and I will be happy to answer any questions that have come up.
Sure. I'll remind everybody that that small window in the lower right is still available to send in your questions and comments for our speakers. I just will chime in here. Additionally, we've had a few people comment on some of the visualization you've been providing with your data and your MIP data in 3D. So I think people are very interested in your display techniques, and perhaps you guys might be showing them some more later on. But I just wanted to convey that interest in it.
Okay.
The other question we had, could you talk a little bit about the depth of some of those nested injection wells that you had at the site?
Yeah, I can do that. And Jeff, you can certainly weigh in. This is an interesting challenge because you couldn't simply go out. We certainly didn't want to have one borehole per well. That's certainly not cost effective. And we realized that we couldn't have one borehole full of six wells because we ultimately needed to inject from 5 to 100 feet below ground surface. So in many of our cases, in the deepest portion of our plume, we've got two nested well clusters. And what we end up doing is essentially jockeying back and forth between those two borings. So we'll have the shallowest well, an intermediate well, and the deep well within one of the borings, and then we'll have kind of an offset configuration in the other. And that allows us to have an adequate amount of grout and bentonite between our screens to make sure that we didn't have any kind of pressure problems during injection. I think we actually had, Jeff, maybe you can describe a little bit more about how we were able to apply the grout pellets down to 100 feet. I don't know if we did anything unique with respect to that.
Well, right. So essentially what we're saying is that the well screens are staggered apart from each other so that there's vertical separation between the zones so that you're not getting, injected fluids transmitting between locations, short-circuiting. One of the challenges was how do you get a grout seal down, through basically a 90-foot saturated zone? And it turns out, and this is something I always find ironic, is that if you read the instructions on a bag of, hole-plug bentonite, it tells you how to do it. And it's that they have to be screened. The little chips that come in the bag, if you run them through a quarter-inch sifter or 3/8-inch screen that a driller can make, and you basically sift out all the fines, those pellets will not begin to sort of fluff up and hydrate until they reach the depth. You can drop them many, many tens of feet down into a well and without bridging, and it worked really well. Actually, the drilling crews were all amazed that it continuously worked as well as it did. So we did that to build up the big bentonite zones to get the vertical separation between the pressurized injection zones so that we didn't get short-circuiting.
Do you know the diameter of those three nested wells, the borehole
diameter? 2 inches each. Jeff, what was the biggest borehole? Was it 10 inches or 12 inches?
Yeah, so I think it was an 8 1/4-inch ID hole, so that makes about a 12-inch hole.
Okay.
Yeah, and then we had 3 2-inch diameter injection wells in our largest borings.
Okay.
Right.
We just had also some follow-on questions about your well casing and screen material that you were using.
Let's see here. I don't remember the specifics. I know that our screens are the wire-wrapped PVC for the bulk of the plume. For the areas around the thermal system, we actually installed stainless steel wells because we had to get those in the ground before the ground cooled. So those are stainless steel with wire wrap screens as well. In terms of the sand material, I don't remember what that was, Jeff. I don't know if you at the top of your head.
The sand pack material was, I think, a 10-20 size sand, just sized for the injection screen.
Okay, and the other question that's come in are regarding costs. Do you have any cost information for the thermal component of your remediation?
Yes, you'll have to wait. It's later.
Okay, excellent.
Yes, so that will keep people staying. Yes,
more costs.
We will share the cost. We'll share the cost of all the components of the remedy because this is a big project and it's important to share that information.
It's about 2:08 p.m. right now. Why don't we go ahead on with the presentation, and I'll just remind that audience to keep those questions and comments coming in using that Q&A window.
Thank you. I will continue here. So, in the spirit of optimization, one of the things Jeff and I are focused in on is to continue to optimize, and that's one of the things that we did throughout this entire process. So, no single injection event remained the same because we were trying to learn and optimize. So, what I'm going to touch upon here is 7 key things that we did as part of the operations that we've been doing, the last 8 years. We did a sustainability assessment, you know, basically right after construction complete, focusing on the ejections. We did a comprehensive POC sampling event to really kind of understand, you know, the sort of the duration of our biobarriers. Could we adjust our frequency and perhaps, you know, reduce the ejections? We did some supplemental grab sampling. You know, we've got about over 100 monitoring wells at the site, but even for a 20-acre plume, there's still some gaps, and we used some DPT sampling to kind of close those gaps as well. We looked at methane inhibitor, perhaps, to reduce the amount of methane generation, not only from a risk standpoint, but also from a substrate utilization perspective. Constantly looking at our long-term VOC trends, you know, whether we could, you know, adjust our injections or reduce our sampling frequency. And, of course, some of the, you know, conventional stuff by redeveloping wells to make sure the injection wells are performing as we expect. And then also expanding our monitoring well insulation as the plume shifts. And then finally, Jeff will talk a little bit more about, you know, what we're doing in the VIMS today and beyond. So just quickly on the sustainability assessment, as I mentioned before, we did it right after the thermal treatment phase completed, and really kind of took a hard look at how we're delivering our ERD, you know, since that was a substantial part of the remedy, you know, beyond the thermal. You know, looking at, you know, the greenhouse gases associated with you know, the EVO production, you know, any of the piping we're using and those kinds of things. And ultimately, based on some recommendations as part of the sustainability assessment, we were able to just reduce environmental impacts and costs by 20% simply by using the recommendations from the sustainability assessment. So, you know, that's where right out of the gate some of the optimization we had as part of the site. The next thing was to start looking at, you know, where this is probably around, you know, 2013 to 2015 timeframe. You know, we started our ERD pilot study back in 2008. So we've had a number of years of experience with ERD at the site, and we want to kind of just revisit how long these substrates were staying viable on the ground and then adjust accordingly. Now, one of the benefits we had of having sort of a staggered first injection event because of a variety of, you know, funding restraints and access, we had injection wells that were already sort of on a different cycle. So we went and took advantage of that, and we took POC samples from the actual injection wells, and each of the injection wells had sort of you know, various times since the injections. So we had a sort of a time stamp in terms of the TOC longevity. So those at the time of the TOC sampling event that only had been in the ground for 7 months, we saw TOC geometric mean of 570 parts per million, plenty adequate to sustain the treatment. For wells that were 26 months old, we saw TOC geometric mean of 40 ppm. So, you know, more than an order of magnitude depletion of TOC by the 2-year mark. It was interesting to us that we were seeing, you know, very good sustaining concentrations in the deepest wells that hadn't been injected in nearly three years. So that allowed us to kind of pull back on some of our injections in the deeper zones, and again, sort of save costs for future injection events. So what we decided here is, you know, ultimately we stuck with the 18-month injection cycle. We could have pushed it to 24 months, but there is some benefit to kind of making sure that the injection events overlap over time. But at least it was a check that we were not going overboard with our injection frequency. We also did a check of our monitoring wells just to make sure that beyond our injection area, we were seeing some decent organic substrate concentrations. And by and large, we were seeing the impact of our injection. So it sort of kind of confirmed our conceptual design model that the biobarriers were doing their job. As I mentioned before, we went out there and with a DBT and collected some samples kind of throughout the plume where we were maybe not seeing the progress that we were expecting. So that helped us sort of refine our understanding of our plume. It also allowed us, again, to refine our injection process. So by understanding perhaps where we had some lingering concentrations in areas between our transects, we could implement some temporary DPT injections to kind of accelerate the treatment between the barriers. And we also learned where we were seeing more progress than we had thought, and it allowed us to pull back on some of our injections. So some of the outcomes to this grab sampling exercise was that, it allowed us to reduce the injections to the deeper intervals. That saved us money, and some of the plume periphery, which had already kind of attenuated over time, and then allowed us to also reduce injections in the shallow plume core, where we were very aggressive, but now can pull back. And as you can see here, you know, we've made progress over those first four injection events, going from nearly 300,000 pounds of EBO down to approaching 100,000 pounds just in that period of time. Again, by really focusing our ejections where it needed to be. And then, you know, by also saving costs and making sure the remedy was maintained, we also saw some tremendous GSR, green sustainable remediation benefits also by not using all that equipment. And so what this looks like in practice in terms of complementing our injection well network is this is an example of what we're actually going to be doing this spring. But you can see the blue and red dots where we're enhancing our injection well network with some DPT injection points. The red and blue colors just represent sort of the depth of our target. So, you know, in some cases we're just targeting that upper shallow transmissive zone. In some cases we're doing both the top two zones as well. But you can kind of see that, you know, where we're focusing our attention is, you know, where some of the concentrations have remained. And this is the CIS map, CIS PCE map. You know, as we've been very aggressive up here, we've been able to collapse the plume, but where we've had to space our transects farther apart, you know, it's been a little bit slower, so we're kind of giving it a hand with the injection of our substrate via DPT. And that's really the point of these enhanced DPT injections. The other thing that we did also is that we took advantage of the GRAB sampling event to take a harder look at the abiotic component. You know, certainly if we can sort of kickstart the abiotic process by forming and sustaining iron sulfides, it really, you know, would allow us to inject a lot less frequency. That essentially kind of works by itself. So we collected a number of soil samples in a number of depth intervals representing, you know, different lithologies and different PCE concentrations. And we collected, we analyzed for magnetic susceptibility, acid volatile sulfides, and total iron. The magnetic susceptibility is used to estimate the magnetite concentration of the soil, and without getting into great details, but essentially gives the sense of the reactivity of the natural materials for dechlorinating some of these chlorinated ethanes. The ABS gives a sense of the amount of iron sulfide, so the actual iron sulfide created as part of this process. And then the total iron is sort of just a check on whether or not those first two tests are relatively accurate. And relatively surprising, given the amount of iron and sulfites at the site, we actually found very little evidence of abiotic dechlorination at the site. And it was a little bit of a head scratcher, but very low magnetic susceptibility levels, very little iron sulfide generation, and frankly, the patterns that we were seeing with the dechlorination process going from PCE to TCE to DCE to monochloride was more representative of the classic biological dechlorination rather than the abiotic. So we sort of concluded that, you know, although that would have been nice to have, it wasn't something that was really supporting us, and we needed to focus our attention on making sure the bio was happening as efficiently as possible. Then we turned our attention to methane inhibition. This was about the time where that product was kind of fresh to the market. So we wanted to see if we could control our methane production as well as perhaps improve the utilization of our substrate. The more the substrate is converted to methane, the less that it's available for the fermentation, for the sustaining the dechlorination process. We saw the number of vapor monitoring points kind of scattered throughout this transect. This is our oldest transect. This is the one where we had our pilot studies. We had the most long-term information for the site. We also did some monitoring injection wells, the head spaces, and we also looked at water meter vaults and manholes. And the idea is that, you know, wherever methane could be generated and move forward, we looked at. We collected baseline data 1 month after injection, 4 months after injection to look at the methane changes. We also did the same kind of frequency at some of the transects where we did not apply the methane inhibitor. And we really looked and see if there was any kind of difference. And ultimately what we found was that it really was not effective for this particular site. So again, though it would have helped us, we learned that it was not a particular part of our optimization tool, but you know, certainly did help us moving forward. As the case for many of our sites, we routinely looked at our DVOC trend data. We sampled 120 monitoring wells annually and realized that we were seeing, you know, below detection limits at a number of wells and below MCLs at a number of wells. So we revised our sampling network to convert several of them to biennial and even triennial sampling, again, to kind of reduce costs for long-term without compromising our ability to collect information for the site. And again, another sustainability benefit for ourselves. Again, along the ideas of optimization, we were routinely kind of getting feedback from the field in terms of which injection wells were either beaten up from being in the road traffic or we had declining injection rates. So we frequently would go out there and repair wellheads and do redevelopment in order to sustain the injection rates that, again, minimize the time in the field and reduce costs for us as well. We also were able to repurpose some of the injection wells that had been retired because we didn't need them anymore as monitoring wells. So that was certainly helpful for our monitoring program without costing us any more money. And we also kind of adjusted our wells based on sort of the plume evolution over time. And with that, I'll kind of turn it back over to Jeff to talk a little bit where we stand with the VIMS and our LTRA.
All right. Thank you again. excuse me. The O&M of the mitigation systems is required, of course, to ensure that they're in operation or, at the very least, at least in operable condition should a residence, frankly, choose to turn them off. We need to make sure they're still in operable condition. Periodic repairs are required already since what? We put the first set in late 2008, 2009. Several of the mitigation fans have required replacement due to failure. I mean, these things are on 24/7. So we've gotten good life cycle out of them. But then some pipe hangers and one mitigation barrier have also required repairs. One thing we have found is that non-fan related repairs have found to be the result of factors that we don't consider to be normal wear and tear. Specifically, what I mean is that the homeowner probably did something that caused the problem. People have had the gutters worked on where the pipes were nearby and they were disturbed. Plumbing repairs inside their crawl space where, you know, the barrier was cut to fix a pipe and it wasn't repaired. So those are the types of things that our routine visits are able to capture, and then we can put those back in good working order, as well as trying to communicate to the owner, hey, you know, it's really in your best interest. There's no penalty here for you just doing work on your house, but if something happens to the VIMS, please let us know. Again, we've talked repeatedly about the soil, the VOC concentrations potentially decreasing due to declining source strength as the plume is remediated. So we're working on checking to see if the concentrations no longer support a completed pathway. And again, keeping in mind daughter products are now present that weren't there before. Here again is the CIS map, the CIS-12-DCE, and with the structures with the mitigation systems overlaying on it, you can see that there are, and the CIS is used because it's got generally the largest footprint of remaining chlorinated ethenes. So you can see there's some gaps, some things that are still close. Structure 4, sort of in the middle center there, is off the edge of a piece of the plume that's still there. Structure 1 and 2 are behind the Holiday Cleaner source area, and they're, that's largely gone. So these are things that we're gonna keep in mind, and these are some locations that we're gonna go back and look at and see, is the still warranted? Go ahead.
So that brings us to 2017, and we had completing multiple injection events and all of our optimizations. And by this point in time, we had reduced the CVOC mass across the site by 95% after 8 years of the RA. The ICT influence had obviously come down a little bit as that was stagnant, down to 75%. But again, within the ERD influence, we've seen 80% reduction in total mass where we've been doing the injections. Most of the CVOC mass is the CIS and vinylchloride, with more of it kind of moving to the vinylchloride as we move through the chlorination system. You can see the right two just kind of show the progression of the mass over time. And as Jeff noted before, mostly it's probably CIS right now at the site. You can almost see that our injections are fairly well timed as sort of the mass loss, kind of becomes asymptotic over time. We hit it again with ERD and we see a progression of treatment. So, that sort of is a feedback loop that tells us that our injection cycle is probably about as optimal as we can get right now. So one of the tools that we've been using to help track our progress is the EBS, or a 3D monitoring. And it's really helped us understand the progression of the plume and make adjustments to the way that we're monitoring an injection. So we basically took all of our data from the beginning of our remedy every year and really kind of appreciate the progress over time. So this is the PC. You can see, again, moving from baseline conditions to where we are today, you know, considerable decrease in the plume footprint. TC as well, following the same pattern. And again, after I show these, I'll show an animation showing, you know, better how this has progressed over time. Again, TCE has depleted in the source areas, and now we're working on the downgraded portion of the plume. As you'd expect, you know, we saw a little bit of cyst in the beginning, and that cyst that we saw in September 2010 was essentially the cyst that was created as a result of the petroleum plume that was, you know, commingling with our site. And again, as we've depleted the PC and TC, we've created the cyst. And then vinyl chloride, we went from essentially nothing. And that 2010 numbers is probably what was there after our pilot study. So that's kind of the beginning of our treatment process. So we've been generating vinyl chloride, and even the vinyl chloride has been progressing down to ethene as well. And here I would like to kind of just show a cart, you know, kind of an animation of how we're using this EBS model, if we could. I'm going to do that. Give me 1 second.
Okay. So Mike is going to switch over to a screen sharing mode. And for those of you who are in the webinar, I'll draw your attention in the far upper right corner of where his screen share is now appearing live. Mike, I just want to let you know we can see those four dims up on the screen. You all have additional controls in addition to expanding the window to make it larger. You can also zoom in even further and then use the scroll bars to kind of pan around and recenter as needed. Mike, feel free to take it away.
Thanks. So this has been really instrumental for us. So we've been integrating our monitoring well data and our DPT data and able to really understand the progression of the plume over time, and allows us to kind of focus our attention on how the plume has moved over time. So again, playing basically the last 10 years of plume transformation, you can see how, you know, we're really taking care of the deep portion of the zone, and really what's left is in the shallow component of the plume. We've created these for all the constituents. This is TCE. Really seeing how things move. And again, you know, where we have the thinnest or the least dense injection well network, we focus our DPT injections there as well. And then looking at, bear with me, this is our cyst plume map. You know, you can see how it's changed over time. Again, I'll play kind of the side view as well. And then lastly, you can see how vinyl chloride has shown up, and then subsequently been depleted. So this has been really handy to do. Again, every time we do a monitoring event, we add to our system, and have created this graphic. This also presents very nicely to update stakeholders. It has really been an asset to us as well. So Gene, I'm going to kind of come back to our presentation, if we could.
Okay, and Mike, in just a second, those slides should be back up on your screen, and you can feel free to carry on.
Okay. And then I guess with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Jeff to kind of capture some of our successes and over the course of this project.
Thank you. So these are things that we've largely already talked about. We just want to summarize here things that have gone well for us. Again, the effective use of the cafeteria-style selection process, having the flexibility to pick from multiple technologies that would work based on where you were in the plume, and again, following something such as the value engineering proposition, we were able to hone in and fine-tune those technologies. One thing that we haven't talked about is that these final selections were ultimately memorialized in an ESD, which is the explanation of significant differences that EPA filed to go along with the grant's record of decision, so that you know, the final layout and final application of technologies was memorialized and acknowledged, you know, as a decision that was made for the site. Again, the VE study had considerable technical and financial benefit, as Mike discussed at length. We had the conventional and ARRA funding that allowed us to accelerate some of the remedy construction, largely around the testing and installation of the ERD injection wells. Again, we used ERD primarily within public right-of-way and used permanent injection wells. I mean, we knew how long this was going to take. There's going to be multiple injections over many years. So instead of going back with direct push on a massive scale every event, we just leave these injection wells in public right-of-way, and it minimizes the impact to the community, because all we need to do is bring a pickup truck and a trailer out, run some fire hose for potable water, and set up traffic control, and that happens, you know, like we talked about, every 18 months. Again, the ISTT system was able to operate without disrupting the dry cleaning business, the state highway traffic, or the natural gas line. They were certainly an impact on our process, but, you know, it allowed us to maintain those non or minimal impacts to the stakeholders that were required. We did achieve the construction complete before the end of fiscal year 2012, which had been was important to EPA to get done. And then, of course, we also looked at the ERD biogas generation. You know, there's always the concern about methane. But again, we did not see that here for various reasons, shallow groundwater and unpaved areas adjacent to the injection zones were two of the biggest reasons allowing for the methane to both degrade in the presence of oxygen as well as, frankly, just dissipate also through atmospheric exchange. So as, let me see here. There we go. So some of the optimization successes. So as the project has progressed, you know, and the various treatment processes have been effective, we're now sampling many less quantities of injection wells, or injecting into less injection wells, and have also reduced the annual groundwater monitoring programs. So both of these are decreased. If you look at the second bullet there, you know, up to 30% of our monitoring wells have already been shifted to sampling on a triennial frequency every 3 years, with the rest being determined, you know, to be in key areas where we sample them annually. The substrate injection, you know, the fourth injection event had used 60% less than the first, and the fifth is already going to use only 20% of the initial substrate injection volume. And again, we're down from about 700 wells to roughly 365 wells. Now, of course, as you may suspect, the thermal treatment was done in the source area where the concentrations were highest, and it's also the sort of silver bullet technology, if you will. And, you know, 75% of the mass loss so far has already been attributed to the in-situ thermal treatment. And then after 8 years, 80% of the chlorinated ethane mass in the areas being subjected to the ERD treatment has already been reduced. So currently we're projecting that we're ahead of schedule that was shown in the final remedial design. Also, the optimization efforts to date have been paid for with realized cost savings, so there's been no addition to the life cycle costs of the project to evaluate and take advantage of optimization. And currently, you know, there are additional life cycle cost reductions expected associated with the shorter remediation time frame compared to the design estimate. The example of that is that the RD assumed 13 events over 20 years, and currently the data trends are indicating that somewhere on the order of 7 to 10 events would be needed to achieve the remedial objectives, followed by potentially some MNA in the deeper zones, as well as, you know, long-term monitoring. So here is the cost slide. So what did it cost to implement the remedy here at Grants? ERD has a capital cost of about $5 million and an averaged annual cost about $800,000, although currently that is decreased to about $400,000 due to the optimization and the reduced quantities of injection volume and, of course, associated labor and expenses to get those materials into the ground. Total cost to date for ERD are about $10 million. And again, the ERD is used in the more dilute downgrading portion of the plume. 200 kilograms of mass has been removed at a cost of about $50,000 cost per kilogram. And again, that is being used to treat, generally speaking, the entire 20 acres and about 2 million cubic yards of the plume impacted volume, and cost per yard is about $5. And then for in-situ thermal treatment, $10 million capital cost that included all of the infrastructure, you know, all of the treatment, everything that was shown in those pictures, all of the trenching and piping and electrodes and working around buildings and inside buildings. And again, that's a fixed cost in time, no recurring cost. It was spent and wrapped up in 2012. Removed about 550 kilograms of chlorinated ethene mass. Cost per kilogram was about $18,000, but it treated about three-quarters of an acre total and 30,000 cubic yards at a cost per yard of about $330. And then, of course, the vapor intrusion mitigation system is a fixed capital cost, probably quite a bit less average annual cost than $10,000. You know, but if you factor in some of the stuff we're going to look at now to see about taking them out of service, there'll be some money spent there. But again, nothing, you know, too significant. The occasional fan and barrier repairs are relatively cost effective and easily done. So total cost to date are about $750,000 plus, you know, a little bit more, and about a $50,000 cost per structure. So, as we talked about, the site is getting ready towards the later this year. Actually, it's before the end of federal fiscal year 2020. The site is transitioning from federal to state. So it's going from EPA Region 6 to the state of New Mexico. So the current plan is to transition the long-term response actions from basically the EPA contractor, us, Jacobs in this case, and CH2M, to the state of New Mexico and whoever their contractor is. Now, the LTRA period, which is 10 years following the operation and functional determination, is still ongoing. So it is going to the state a little bit early, but EPA and the state of New Mexico will work out the funding for that, how that works. Normally, the LTRA is paid for 90% by the federal government and 10% by the local by the states in which the site project lies. So I imagine that that will continue through LTRA, except that it will be under the purview of the state. We are currently providing cost and schedule information, you know, what still needs done per the RD, you know, and the RA to implement the remedy, so that both of these agencies can plan from a cost and schedule standpoint. We're going to try and abandon some injection and monitoring wells that are no longer needed. There are some out along the plume periphery that are definitely ready to be taken out of service after, you know, multiple events of demonstrating that they've met remedial goals. Also, as Mike talked about, we're going to do some enhanced DRD with those temporary DPT points that he showed in the red and the blue colors, you know, down to a depth of roughly 25 feet. So generally in the downgrading portion of the plume in the more shallow areas. Again, we're looking at the VIMS evaluation. Can anything come out of service? Also, we're preparing enhanced data summary dashboards, which I'm going to show here in a second. And also reassessing role of MNA as part of the strategy. And then simply looking at the logistics of the project transfer going to New Mexico to the NMED. Folks on their end will need training, at least the project management folks will need training on the groundwater sampling. How do we do that? And in this case, the state of New Mexico has provided in-kind services to EPA over the years where they've actually provided sampling teams to assist with the annual groundwater sampling. For many years now, so they're actually keenly aware of the groundwater sampling program, and then the injection processes. We're going to get them up to speed on, show them how the trailers work, and generally the logistics of the event, and then also obviously a project status memorandum that transfers, you know, as much of the knowledge as we can to the state so that they have that information as they take over the project. So. Gene, if you can also get me to the
all right,
screen.
And as Jeff calls it up, remember you all have individual controls on the upper right of his screen share to adjust whether you want to go full screen or zoom in further. And Jeff, we can see that dashboard up live.
Okay, so this is the dashboard that we have created. It lives on an internal server that we maintain with our GIS folks. And basically what it is it's got for each of our transects generally broken down with some logic of what we're trying to show. And this is the So these are the site monitoring and injection wells. There's also the groundwater contours shown on this map. We can zoom in and get as close and as specific to any well as we like. There are some filters over on the left that will allow us to show analytes in our grids. We can show vinyl chloride, TCE, PCE, and I'm just going to give a brief overview of this, but and then here is the CIS, and you can see, you know, the changes over time by location, and it's just a pretty powerful tool. You can also look at different flags, you know, things that were detected, validation qualifiers, date ranges, groundwater contours on and off, and by year. You can see that these are our monitoring events, which generally occur in the August and September timeframe of each year. So you could select each of those. And then you can also look at, you know, whether you want to show the, which part of the plume you want to show on these graphs as you go through time. And then if you zoom in on each of these boxes, each of the plots, the time concentration versus time data, you can then, in this case, we are looking at the CIS. You hover over, and it will show you the date and the actual concentration, you know, as you go through time. So there's a lot of different things we can see and show here. And it's just a good tool for someone who is perhaps reviewing a report or has questions about data, one of the key stakeholders. They can see, you know, okay, just I want to know something about the groundwater flow, or I want to know about the groundwater contours. So basically, it's a repository for all of our geochemical and analytical data in one location, allows you to do comparative analysis. Our vision is to ultimately have it include the injection data. And, you know, at its most basic level, you can access all of the site data by clicking through at these multiple levels and locations in the dashboard. So it's a powerful tool in that it sort of makes everyone's life easier. People that maybe aren't as familiar with the site, and certainly from my standpoint as a project manager, I can share this with others, and we can sort of take a drive through the site. And that's a powerful thing. And, you know, it's pretty neat. I mean, it's a very enjoyable tool to have and to use and to share with key stakeholders. So, Jean, if we can go back to the presentation.
Yep, and we're transitioning back to those slides, and you'll have those back up on your screen in just a moment.
Okay, so that actually is the end of the presentation. So, Mike, if you want to give a little summary.
No, I just appreciate everybody's attention. You know, this really gave us a full perspective on this project, you know, beginning in the, you know, middle 2000s all the way till today, and really hopefully portrayed some of the interesting work we've done and some of the challenges we've had to overcome. And we'll be happy to answer some questions either now or, you know, certainly via email if it strikes you later.
Okay. Well, I do have a bunch of questions in the queue, so we're going to go through as many as we can. And my apologies if I bounce around a little bit, but we've got a lot of different questions coming in from people. So I'm just going to start here about eliminating phytoremediation. Some participants are questioning what exactly was it that eliminated phytoremediation from the, quote, creative process of the VE study. What, did you wind up comparing it in terms of cost to M&A?
Ooh, this is going back about 11 years. My hunch is that, you know, we prepare cost estimates for every single of the ideas that we generated. And I ultimately, that certainly was a factor. I think there probably was a factor trying to grow a healthy phytoremediation community in a fairly arid and paved environment. There certainly was some areas at the site where it was earthen and could have been the case. But I think that given the amount of time and perhaps uncertainty with the Fido, it wasn't picked for the remedy. But I don't think there's any – I can't recall anything specific about Fido that was particularly unattractive. It just didn't seem to rise to the top.
Okay. Again, going back to that value engineering study, one of the attendees noted that VE study decreased ISTT from about 8 million to 6 million. And then they wanted to know what occurred to bring it back up to $10 million.
Yes, that's good. So when we first had the preliminary design, our vision was to treat from basically ground surface down to 80 feet below ground surface. And that was going to be our thermal treatment process. And I think that was our initial, that was probably our $8 million number. And I would say that number probably was ignorant of all of the challenges we had to face in terms of burying, a lot of the components in the street, as well as having to really understand and deal with the dry cleaner. So initially our reduction going from 8 to 6 was to, because we brought up the bottom of the thermal treatment system from 80 to 40 feet and replaced that with an expanded ERD system below it. The level of concentrations at depth didn't warrant the thermal treatment, and it was just frankly by a unit cost rate a lot more sensible to do the ERD below it. The cost went up again from there because I think we really, once we got through the design process and the procurement, I think we really probably fully appreciated the complexity of building this thermal system in an urban area. And I think there's also, it may be slightly misleading because that $10 million likely includes all of our time, meaning Jacobs and CH2M, every single thing included in the delivery of the project, whereas the $6 million number probably was more focused in on the thermal contractor itself. So I think the important thing is to look at making it from 8 to 6 sort of in that context, and then the growth, we probably increased back up to 8 again, but that did account for all the complexities, and then $2 million for all the other things that surround such an implementation. So I'm sorry if that's confusing, but at least the first stair step makes sense because we changed the size of it to be more efficient for the remedy.
Okay. We've had a few questions about some of the vinyl chloride at the site. Some of the attendees are asking if you have any plans or what your plans are long-term for addressing VC.
So that's a very good question. We have evidence that we're seeing complete dechlorination of the site. So in some respects, there's a little bit of patience involved here. I think some of the reasons why we're seeing some of the cysts and the vinyl chloride kind of sustain itself in some portions of the site is that we weren't able to have the injection density that we did. Back up in the shallow plume core, going back towards the source area, we had a very aggressive injection system. And we've essentially eliminated all the chlorine ethenes in that area, so we actually saw the complete dechlorination process. So what our first step in trying to address it is more injections between the permanent injection well transect. So we're trying to deploy the DPT as best as possible to kind of bridge that gap. Certainly the next step in the process could be using some of the newer products, where we combine EVO and ZVI, for example, or maybe even considering shifting over to a ZVI-only blend of some of those injectable products. So we're certainly keeping our eye on it, but I think the process has not so much been a failure of technology, but has been a difficulty in logistics in terms of getting to where we want to go, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. Just out of curiosity, did you consider or are there any plans for perhaps bioaugmentation in the areas of your vinyl chloride where it's getting generated?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes. We have bioaugmented most of the injection wells within the plume. And we are also including bioaugmentation in a number of our DPT injection wells too. So our assumption is that has helped, but it's what we have found is, more carbon, closer space wells has been effective, and that's really what our focus in right now is to do more in areas that are gaps. But yes, we've put bugs in the ground, and the Dahalcocoides population and the reductase populations have thrived around the biobarriers where we've had success. And in fact, we've actually seen the life cycle of the Dahalcocoides where they've thrived, and then once all the chlorinated ethenes have gone away, they've actually died back. So, again, sort of to beat a dead horse, this has really been an access issue in trying to get the carbon where we need to really kind of reduce those remediation timeframes.
Okay, and just to confirm, have you seen any stalling out of the cyst-DCE with your ERD treatment?
No. No, not where we've been able to sustain the injections. It has not been a problem. So, again, I think what's happened is that as you get between the transects, it becomes a bit more stubborn, and that's where we're trying to hit it harder. But where we've had intensive ERD, we've had complete dechlorination process.
Okay. And then we still have some questions coming back to cost. So
yep.
This participant wanted to know, what were the costs for power to the thermal remediation system?
Oh, I meant to say that. So over the 6 months of heating, it was $800,000 worth of power.
All right. Okay. And scrolling back through here, some earlier questions about this. A lot of interest in copies of your presentation materials and if the session will be available later on. We will answer those questions in just a moment before we close things out. I wanted to take time now to make sure we focus on our content-related questions with our speakers while we have them on the line. And I'm not sure if you can get into any risk discussions, but there were some questions coming in about differences in risks at the site that were pre-remedial versus post-remedial. So in terms, as a result of the remedial work, how has that impacted risk at the site?
Well, Jeff, I don't know if you want to build this one. Go ahead.
Well, are we talking, I'm thinking it's potentially related to the vinyl chloride issue.
Yeah.
So those are addressed in, you know, we do have remedial goals for those. So, I mean, we still are being held to those. And, again, you know, I think both Mike and I have talked about, you know, his concern with the groundwater and my concern with the, you know, potential vapor intrusion that, you know, we are both cognizant of that and we are taking steps to, you know, use the direct push injections in to be more aggressive in the plume. And then also looking at, you know, the vapor intrusion mitigation systems again, you know, just to see, you know, where those, what those data look like.
But Jeff, I think having the VIMs above the plume sort of affords us a little bit of patience with getting the groundwater, right? Because the primary risk right now at the site is vapor intrusion, and that's at least mitigated for the time being.
That is correct. And right. And we certainly knew that going through the process, you know, you would be going through the steps of the dechlorination process from PCE, you know, all the way through vinyl chloride into the ethene. So that was taken into account.
Yeah, certainly, you know, we're not being cavalier about its presence. You know, but we have seen evidence that we're able to take it all away. It's just a matter of hitting it hard enough.
Okay. And then I'm going to go back to an earlier question regarding some of the RI work. And I believe someone picked up on a comment that there were no actual wells installed during the RI. Could you just confirm what information or data you had during the RI?
Sure. So the RI, there were wells within the footprint of the plume that was, you know, were associated with a nearby gas station that had been also impacted by the chlorinated solvents. There were some additional wells installed during the preliminary assessment site inspection by the state of New Mexico, and then there were a fair number of direct push borings completed by both CH2M Hill and the USGS, where, you know, groundwater samples were collected and sent to, you know, a fixed base lab. They weren't screening level; they were data for decision making. And so we did have a fairly robust data set, although we did not end up putting in, you know, any monitoring wells. But they did identify, you know, from those sample locations, certainly identified the hottest or highest PCE number that, you know, had ever been found at the site. I think it was somewhere on the order of 72 milligrams per liter of PCE in groundwater near the Holiday cleaners. So those are the data that were used, you know, for the decision-making going forward.
Gene, are you still there?
Oh, sorry, yeah, I'm here. I apologize. So it looks like we've been able to get through most of the technical questions that we had in the queue. So I think perhaps in the interest of time, Jeff or Mike, do you guys have any final thoughts you want to leave the audience with before I head back to Kate with a few quick reminders and then we close things out today?
I don't. I think I've shared all I can share for the site, but yeah, I'm sure you'll get to sharing slides and that kind of stuff in a moment.
Exactly. So.
Yeah, right. I would like to thank everybody for you know, listening in. And again, if you have questions, obviously you can reach out to the speakers. And you know, the information will be up and available, you know, which you're going to talk about in a minute. But I'd encourage people to, you know, dig in a little deeper.
Okay. All right. So I think we'll go through just a few quick reminders here. Kate, if you are on the line, I want to just give you a chance to remind everybody that this is part of an ongoing series, and then I'll come back in to close out with some of those reminders about accessing materials and the recorded version. So, Kate?
Yes, Jean, thank you. And again, thanks to Jeff and Mike for a great presentation. I think it was well-received and a lot of information for people to digest. What Jean's put up on the screen is, as I mentioned before, this is a webinar in a series of DCHWS webinar series. The next three webinars are put up there for your reference. The next webinar is March 11th from 1:30 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The registration link is open, and you can find it in the slide deck here. I encourage you, if this topic is of interest to you, to share with your colleagues and register as appropriate. We're moving into some different topics in the April and May webinar series. Jean and I will most likely make sure within the next couple weeks that those two webinar events are open for registration. So again, keep your eyes open on Cluin and the TechDirect mailer that goes out to see what future opportunities we have for upcoming webinars. So with that, Jean, I will turn it back to you.
Okay. All right, with that, I'll walk through just a few quick reminders before we close things out today. First, I want to thank our organizers and speakers who took time to share their expertise and knowledge, as well as the audience. We had about 130 people from actually all over the world today, so I really appreciate everybody joining us. Today's session is part of an ongoing series and was recorded, so we'll continue to archive and make these sessions available. So you can find the previous seminars delivered in the series already available at cluin.org. If you follow the links along the top to get to our archived or recorded webinars, you can access these along with a wealth of other previously recorded webinars that we've hosted. As Kate was mentioning, we'll continue to offer these sessions. I strongly encourage you guys to sign up for our monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, because we do announce these sessions along with links on how you can register for them on the first of each month. You can also visit us at cluin.org. But I will remind everybody that copies of the presentation material are already posted on the seminar resources or links page. We talked about that at the beginning. You would have used that page to get connected to today's webinar. Just look for the tabs along the top of that page, and you'll see a tab to the seminar links or related resources page. I also have them pasted on the middle of your page. If you look on the middle right under related URLs, there's a collection of resources on today's webinar. Scroll through the list to pick the one of interest, click it to select it, and then press the Browse To button to open it on your end. If you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version, those links will still work for you, so you can scroll through, click them, and open them up based off of the archive playback. I will ask each of you to fill out our online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. One of the most common requests I personally get is if we offer certificates for joining our webinars. We do offer those certificates, but the only way you can get one of those is to fill out our online feedback form. What's really important when you're filling that form out is that you check a box at the bottom of the form to certify you are here for the whole session and make sure your own email address is entered correctly on that form. As long as you do those two things, as soon as you submit feedback, you'll immediately have access to a certificate that you can print or download for your own records. If you happen to join together as a group in a conference room, each person can actually fill out that feedback form, even if they didn't individually register. So please, if you organized a group to watch with you, share the link to the seminar feedback form so that they can share their own thoughts and get their own certificate for their records. And then as I noted, today's session was recorded. You should get an email from me in about 1 week or so when that archive is available for on-demand playback. And so with that, I'll go ahead and thank everybody once more for joining us, and we'll formally conclude today's live broadcast.